For Arizona Public Media, I'm Mark Dugan, and this is Arizona Spotlight. Coming up, hear how this weekend's Southwest Indian Art Fair is connecting people to Native American culture. Learn how a somewhat famous Russian movie director tried and failed to make a movie about Mexico in the 1930s. Meet a young refugee from Tanzania and hear his interview with another refugee on what it's like adapting to life in Tucson. And go inside the world of Hank Topless, whose life has many similarities to a honky-tonk song. That's all coming up next on Arizona Spotlight. The 20th annual Southwest Indian Art Fair is this weekend. The Tucson event features Native American art, demonstrations of pottery and weaving, and music and dance performances. This year's fair has more than 200 artists and more than a dozen different performances. Darlene Lizarraga is with the Arizona State Museum, which organizes the art fair. We asked her to give us a little history of the event and to preview what attendees can expect this year.
Well, back in 1993, that year the museum was celebrating its centennial, having been established in 1893. And as part of that year's celebrations, the museum's collections division came up with the idea to have a pottery fair on the front lawn. And so I'm told that that event had about 75 artists from around the region, including many of the major pottery-producing cultures from New Mexico. And since then, the event has grown and evolved into what we now call the Southwest Indian Art Fair, and includes more than 200 artists, and includes not just pottery, but all manner of Southwest Native arts.
Now, there are a number of Native American art fairs, especially in the Southwest. How does this one rate overall in terms of size?
I would say if you compare it to those larger events, the Heard Museum, Santa Fe Indian Market, we're considerably smaller, but we enjoy that. We celebrate specifically the Native cultures of the Southwest, whereas those other events, which are wonderful, include artists and cultures from outside the Southwest.
This is the 20th year of the Southwest Indian Art Fair. What's different this year versus previous years?
This year, we're very proud to have Grammy-nominated artists Carlos Nakai and Will Klipman.
Now, is the aim of the Southwest Indian Art Fair just to connect sellers and buyers of Native American art? With all the performances and demonstrations, is it just as much about exposing people to Native cultures?
Yes. It's not just music, but there are also dance performances and demonstrations. For instance, we have a Navajo weaving demonstration tent, and we have Barbara Ornelas, who is a master Navajo weaver. She will have five generations of her family demonstrating. They will all be demonstrating different aspects of Navajo weaving, and of course talking about the importance of that, of weaving to the Navajo people, the history, and what it means not only to her family, but to her people as a whole. We are struck time and again every year at the comments that we get from not only the artists, but from the participants about how they appreciate the ability of the art fair to help break down barriers through conversation, through art, through food, through dance, through music, and to encourage conversation and therefore encouraging cultural understanding.
Tell me about this year's featured artist. I read somewhere that he can actually see a finished piece in his mind's eye before he even starts to work on it.
Well, Jerry Koitskova is just wonderful. He is from the Hopi culture. He is a katsina carver, but he also works in other media as well. And I remember back in 2010 chatting with him. He was explaining to me that he was sort of branching out and carving in other media. And he had expressed this idea that when he sees a piece, whether it's cottonwood root or a piece of marble or alabaster, he knows exactly what's going to come out of that. And I said, that sounds to me exactly like Michelangelo. That's exactly how he had expressed his ability to see in a piece of stone exactly what was there. And it was his job just to pull that out, to facilitate the pulling out of that object. And so that's exactly Jerry's philosophy. That's how he works. And we're just so proud to have him as our featured artist this year.
That's Darlene Lizarraga with the Arizona State Museum, which is hosting the 20th annual Southwest Indian Art Fair this weekend. I'm Mark Dugan, and this is Arizona Spotlight. Sergei Eisenstein is considered to be one of the greatest Soviet film directors. In 1925, he made Battleship Potemkin, a cinematic masterpiece that's still being dissected and taught in film schools today. But there's also a little-known yet important episode in Eisenstein's career, his failed attempt in the 1930s to make a film about Mexico. With more, here's film writer Chris DeShiel.
Russian director Sergei Eisenstein was interested in Mexico since his youth, and this was later fueled by his friendship with the great Mexican painter Diego Rivera, who often visited Russia in the 1920s. After the worldwide success of Potemkin in 1925, Stalin granted permission for Eisenstein to visit the West to make a movie and bring some of the advanced skills developed there back to the Soviet film industry. In 1930, Eisenstein made a deal with Paramount and went to Hollywood, hobnobbing with Charlie Chaplin and others. He was a most self-assured and assertive young man. With his wide grin, high forehead, and curly hair, he looked like an impish, overgrown child. He was a committed communist, but his ideas about art were audacious and unconventional, to say the least. All his story proposals were rejected by the studios. He then had the idea of a movie about Mexico. After all, it was only just across the border. And Chaplin suggested that he approach the famous writer Upton Sinclair for help. Sinclair seemed the perfect choice. The foremost socialist in the United States, his best-selling books were very popular in Russia. Sinclair agreed to meet with Eisenstein and was enthusiastic. Then when Eisenstein was asked to estimate the cost, he went to a bookseller that he knew, a man who had fought alongside Pancho Villa, and asked him how much money it might take to make an average-length documentary about Mexico. That's how the ridiculously low figure of $25,000 was arrived at. Eisenstein never had to think about money in the Soviet Union. Everything was financed by the state, and Sinclair was an amateur. The director and his team crossed the border in December of 1930. All footage would be shipped to Sinclair in Los Angeles and developed there. After 2 months in Oaxaca, Mexico City, and elsewhere, Eisenstein was just getting accustomed enough to his new surroundings to develop an outline. The budget was then doubled to $50,000, and much of Sinclair's time would be taken up with raising funds from friends, a task which turned out to be difficult because of the Depression. The film would be in 5 episodes, each illustrating a different aspect of Mexican culture and history. Filming kept getting delayed by rain, cloudy days, and sickness. In May and June of 1931, the third and most successful sequence, entitled Maguey, depicting the rebellion of 3 peasants against a brutal landowner, followed by their execution, buried up to their necks and trampled by horses, was filmed. Eisenstein wired Sinclair to say he would need another $15,000. Sinclair wanted to just show Maguey separately as a single film, and this outraged the Russian. The truth is that the atmosphere of freedom in Mexico, such a contrast to life in Soviet Russia, was inspiring Eisenstein to greater heights of creativity. His plans for the film became more grandiose, even as Sinclair, who was ill along with his wife and bleeding financially as well, was demanding he finish it. In October, Eisenstein asked for an additional $20,000 to $25,000. Then came the thunderbolt. A telegram from Stalin himself announced that Eisenstein had lost the trust of his Soviet comrades and must return home. Eisenstein desperately tried to finish the film. The final section was to depict an episode in the campaigns of Zapata's army during the revolution. But the money had run out. Before leaving for Russia, Eisenstein's despair and fury compelled him to an action which turned out to be one of his worst mistakes. He packed a trunk of unwanted things and sent it to Sinclair, who had to claim it at the customs office. When the trunk was opened in Sinclair's presence, scattered on top of the belongings was a series of homoerotic sketches. Sinclair may have been a socialist, but he was also a prude, and this was the last straw for him. He refused to let Eisenstein have the film. He then edited the Maguey section and released it alone as a short film. Other bits of footage showed up in other films over the years. Sinclair was vilified by the left for this episode, and he moved more to the center, eventually running for governor of California as a Democrat in 1934, and almost winning. He continued to write successful books, winning the Pulitzer Prize in 1942. Shortly before his death in 1970 at the age of 90, he agreed to let Eisenstein's assistant, Grigory Alexandrov, reconstruct the film. The name of this unfinished film, this ruin, is Que Viva Mexico, Long Live Mexico. It's available on DVD in the version put together by Alexandrov in 1979. Since the plan to make a synchronized soundtrack never happened, all we have is some music and a narration by Alexandrov to what is essentially a silent film.
Время в прологе.
There are moments of great power and beauty, notably the Magee episode, and a brilliant sequence showcasing Day of the Dead celebrations with all their skull masks and pageantry, and in which Eisenstein intended to symbolize that the spirit of the Mexican people could never die. Yet, the movie is still a series of fragments. We will never know what it would have looked like if the director could have finished it. Eisenstein was always bitter about his Mexican film. He made 4 more pictures in his life, all of them censored and some even condemned. He died in 1948 at the age of 50. It's a remarkable story. The brilliant director, who achieved fame infusing propaganda with the fire of art, came to a land he had dreamed of since youth and found there a new dimension in himself. Warmth, humor, sensuality, and a kind of spirituality as well. The little Mexican movie grew into his most ambitious and imaginative effort. But there were other forces at work. Money, politics, and power struggles. The very necessity to compromise with others in order to achieve one's vision. Eisenstein was inexperienced in all these areas, and it cost him dearly. It's the old story of the genius who founders on the demands of the day-to-day. The Mexican Dream was a beautiful romance. It was also a tragedy.
Chi ci sarà dietro questa maschera? Forse il figlio della soldadera, destinata a vedere il Messico finalmente libero.
For Arizona Spotlight, this is Chris DeShiel.
And I'm Mark Dugan. This is Arizona Spotlight from Arizona Public Media. Coming up, a young refugee from Tanzania interviews another refugee about adapting to life in America and in Tucson. That's next here on Arizona Spotlight. Welcome back to Arizona Spotlight. I'm Mark Dugan. Mark McLemore returns as host next week. Last year, Arizona Spotlight brought you a series of radio stories from producer Bria Dolnick called New Americans. Its purpose was to share personal stories about the refugee experience from some of Tucson's newest residents. Last semester at Catalina Magnet High School, Bria became the after-school mentor to a small group of teenagers who wanted to learn how to produce radio stories. The only thing these students had in common was that they were all international refugees, each of them struggling with the usual range of teenage issues, while also facing huge cultural and personal transformations. Today, we'll hear a story produced by Itango Ikoichi, an 18-year-old originally from Tanzania.
My name is Meharia Malay, and I'm the Extended Services Case Manager here at the International Rescue Committee, Tucson office.
How do you like your job of being caseworker?
I love my job. I know it gets challenging, but the outcome is really rewarding. So seeing clients succeed in the long run, it really helps me do my job better.
Speaking of challenges, what are like some challenges that you face?
For example, we have clients that they come here, they do not know the country, the culture, you know, they do not speak the language. Some of them are pre-literate, so there's no background education.
The relationship between the client mm-hmm. and you guys.
So the IRC's role and the staff at IRC, we're basically a helping hand. And sometimes clients, they come with some information, either they misunderstand or they come with information that was given by someone else in the community that, you know, your agency is responsible for doing everything for you, where it's not like that. So our goal is to help clients become self-sufficient so that they can navigate the community. They don't have to depend on IRC. IRC services are only available up to 5 years. So the sooner the clients learn, the better it will be for them in the long run.
Is there like being caseworker was like your dream job?
My dream job is just helping people, working with refugee clients. Gives me a sense of self-fulfillment, and you know, it helps me better understand the challenges that others face so that I don't take things for granted. Me being a refugee really helped me understand other refugees better, and you know, it inspired me to work with other people that are coming here and building their lives.
On the first 6 months when I came here, I just feel like sometimes I just felt alone. The refugee can't like create hate, you know, towards the agencies.
And the best thing that I suggest for when clients feel like that is to communicate with their caseworker and explain how they're feeling, rather than keeping a distance and not coming to the agency. And if you don't come and communicate with us, then a lot of times we don't know. So the best thing to do is talk to your caseworker and explain, you know, this is something that I need help with and I'm really lost.
Yeah, I mean, the first year was awful.
Mm-hmm. It's always really hard.
The first year, I can still imagine, so like, I want to go back to Africa.
Yep, and trust me, the same thing happened to me. Within the first 3 months that I was here as a refugee in 2001, I said the same thing.
There's something I didn't ask and you like to add.
Just, it's been a pleasure working with refugees and especially your family. I love your mom. She's a strong woman. Clients like that, you know, helps me every day to come here and do my job the best that I can, because I know that everybody who come here, they all feel challenged. They all feel like overwhelmed. It's just that you have to have patience. So you have to work together with your caseworker. And then in the long run, you will see that maybe today it's not going well, but a year from now or 2 years from now, everything will be all right. You just have to have patience and, you know, work really hard. And we are here to help.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's Itongwe Koichi, one of a group of Tanzanian refugees who are students at Catalina Magnet High School. Over the past year, they've been producing their own radio stories from the ground up. Stay with us in the coming weeks to hear more from these young, new Americans who are finding their voices and sharing their stories. Singer, songwriter, and guitarist Hank Topless has lived out the storyline of many a honky-tonk song in his 30-year career. Today, the solo performer is looking forward to the release of his newest single, Skeletons Blues, which is being put out on 7-inch vinyl. Hank Topless dropped by the AZPM studios recently to talk to Mark McLemore about his influences and to play a little guitar for this Spotlight session.
Tell me about your dad's record collection.
My dad had a wide-ranging record collection, and it spanned styles pretty much from Baroque keyboard music to acid rock and bluegrass. My dad was a musician in his teens. He was a singer, an opera singer. He also was a guitar player, a finger-picking guitar player, sort of a home musician. And the record collection would come out, the records would get played many times after I got put to bed. So I'm lying there, I'm 4 or 5 years old. Father, yes, son, I want to kill you. The Doors, the end. That was pretty dark for those days.
Still pretty dark.
But now we have it in context, you know. Ralph Kirkpatrick playing the well-tempered clavier on the harpsichord. Hendrix, Are You Experienced? Burl Ives stuff. Fairly wide-ranging. And my dad was kind of an experimenter with stuff. He would have a honeymoon with stuff, too. He'd hear something or become aware of something and pick it up and then not listen to it a lot. He'd get it home, kind of digest it, and then there it would sit.
And do you feel that that is reflected in your choices as a listener today?
Not the tendency to have a honeymoon with music. I'm suppose I'm a bit opposite in that regard. If I like something, I wear it out. And it's been that way for most of my life, I suppose. Don't listen to a lot of music these days. And I suppose that's because I'm preoccupied by working on my own music. Today it up and rained. Oh, what a happy time. Clouds covered up the sun. Yeah, what a happy time. It took me back to good old 1969. Today it up and rained. Clouds covered up the sun. And all my blues were gone. Yeah, what a happy time.
What kind of areas do you feel are your territory as a songwriter these days?
Topically, anything from kind of a personalized or a window into a personalized experience, kind of a, not quite a stream of consciousness, but I suppose something might be kind of autobiographical, something might be an observation of something outside of myself, to be sure. There's probably a little more of that going on, the outside, looking at the outside. One of the hardest or most challenging parts of the work is to concentrate the ideas, and to a large extent that has to do with lyrics. The musical backing in my songs serves to support the lyrics. There's not a lot of extra music. I kind of hesitate to use the term gratuitous music, but there's not a lot of musical extra kind of pork.
How does the blues fit into this?
That goes back to the very earliest roots, I suppose, for me, so to speak. My earlier songs, you know, 10 years ago, were not quite so hooked into what I might call the blues as they are now. Today, the blues figures in from the angle of the country blues, and by that I would mean music of people who were recording in the 20s and 30s.
Well, you say that 10 years ago your songs would have taken a different form. So what brought this change?
Because I wanted to play the guitar differently. A lot of my earlier things were more based in maybe what you might call sort of a Nashville country style or a honky-tonk style of music. And I still really like that stuff, and certainly that figures in the delivery that I do today. But a guitarist, certainly a singer too, but a guitar player like Mississippi John Hurt, Reverend Gary Davis, Skip James, the sounds those people were getting supplied a really ample backing for their singing. I've certainly done quite a bit of work with bands in the past, but for the last 7 years or so, not 7 or 8 years, I pretty much always will play by myself. So I needed to kick the guitar playing into gear.
I think I know what you're meaning about the emotional timbre of the guitar playing. You said provided ample backing. Do you have that feeling? I mean, is your guitar playing where you want it to be now, where you feel
it's
like
it's never where you want it to be? Playing music is a great challenge. And so performance really for me is a combination of training and accidents.
Oh.
Mockingbird, burning heart, makes you feel like singing to the falling dark. Springtime, you arrive, calling to your lover with a twist and cry. Oh yeah. Calling from the shadow of some midnight tree, the better for your black and shiny eyes to see. And the madness of the morning meets your perfect melody. Mockingbird, swoop and swirl, you twitter in the darkness like a crazy girl. Way up high, on your wire, burbling a ballad about your bad desire. And when the sun goes missing at the close of day, no one hears the robin or the old blue jay. And the sadness and the sickness, you're gonna sing them all the way. When the fallen stars light up the purple sky, and everybody's come down from way up high, it don't matter if you sang the truth or if you sing a lie. Mockingbird, won't you please let me have a lesson right before you leave. Teach me one, maybe two. If you teach me three, you know I just might sing for you.
That's Hank Topless talking with Mark McLemore and performing a spotlight session in the AZPM studios. The interview and songs were recorded and mixed by Jim Blackwood. Thank you for listening to Arizona Spotlight. I'm Mark Dugan for Mark McLemore, who will return as host next week. The show originates from the AZPM studios in Tucson. This week's show was produced and engineered by Mark Dugan with assistance from Jim Blackwood and Mark McLemore. The show music is by Calexico. You can hear the stories again at the Arizona Spotlight page at azpm.org.